Welcome to Warships Pod, and our guest this time is global forecaster, investor, polymath, and author of Breaking the Code of History, David Murrin, who has a talent for spotting and analysing deep-seated patterns in history and using them to try and understand the present and also where we might be going today's turbulent geopolitical scene. So welcome, David.
Thank you very much. It's very kind of you to have me on the show again, Ian.
Yeah, and I think we'll just run through a few hot topics. I know you've got a few topics in mind. And the thing that is dominating the naval news, I suppose, or the defence news, geopolitical news, is the Iran situation and President Trump arriving at the Palace of Versailles, which had all sorts of
connotations,
echoes with history, to sign an agreement with Iran. So have you got much insight into whether or not that's a surrender or it's a wise option for us before we look at some of the specific naval and defence angles?
It's a great question. And I view it as a surrender. All hegemons, and maritime hegemonies especially, rely on the simple physical capability of controlling the oceans and the choke points. And the warning signs came with the Houthis in the Red Sea when the Dwight Eisenhower carrier group went in there to go and directly combat them and spent a number of weeks pummeling them with standard naval air power. And they were resilient. And when the carrier moved away and had used all its ammunition, they popped up and reasserted themselves in the Red Sea. That was the warning sign that something was fundamentally changing across the globe. And that can be traced back to the Iranians and the Chinese via the Iranians, with a strategy of access area denial and essentially from resilient positioning, which we didn't appreciate in the West, how deep those resilient missile cities were in terms of what they were doing and bases that they were using to project power. So America completely discounted, as we know, with Trump, all the advice that came from naval parts of his command system. And the net effect was it was an air dominant campaign. It was a fourth and fifth generation high tempo conflict of, you know, some 14,000 bombs landing, but not significantly strategically with an outcome. And the fact that he surrendered and all of the objectives of Iran were not met, the nuclear capability has been built in Axe Mountain underground. So the nuclear program, I think, is advancing at a considerable pace, and we risk a nuclear breakout in any time we give the Iranians. The Straits of Hormuz are under control of Iran, and they de facto now believe they can control it, which is like a chokehold on the world. And the 33 missile cities, which provide the strategic threat to Israel and the region, are now, you know, all but one or two of them are reconstituted. They have their ammunition. And the mechanism whereby the Chinese basically passed on a hypersonic glide vehicles, HGV technology in the Fatah 2s to the Iranians, which is why they were slicing through the upper levels of the defense dome and the mid-course interceptors of SM-3s and THAADs and the Arrow-3s were worn out trying to intercept these missiles coming through at their mid-course point. And that in turn has now weakened America in the Pacific. So I would argue, as a hegemon, it has failed to impose its will, use its force. And the failure, interesting enough, is a voluntary failure by Trump, because they could have, it's a knockdown, drag out problem. It's an existential war for America, not just an expeditionary war. But if they'd had the intention that they should have had as a more vibrant hegemon and fought for it, I think they could have fought for the Straits of Hormuz. And what they're really fighting for is their hegemony, and Trump surrendered it. And so I think it's disastrous. It's Suez on steroids, and it opens the world up to a frightening future of financial instability, because without maritime hegemony, the financial markets are deeply vulnerable, especially the bond market, which sits on the cusp of a bungee jump in the States and the G7 countries. So the disastrous nature of this cannot be overstated. And I call most of these actions by Trump peace bombs, because he seems to sort of somehow make peace and a bomb goes off that's even bigger afterwards. Because effectively what he's doing is giving the enemies of democracy, the axis of autocracy, time to recover from every blow. And every time he's interceded anywhere with a peace bomb, it's got worse afterwards. And I think this will be exactly the same. I think Trump, if I'm really honest, and I'm on air, so I'm going to be very honest, I think if you judge someone by their actions, in fact, every step he has taken has been dismemberment. And this is just another example of the nail in the coffin of democracy and freedom. by strategically destroying the key alliances, the structures, by entering into a war without congressional support, without NATO support. And although NATO is out of theater at that point, really the whole strength of America is a web of alliances, especially when it's, you know, a long way from home. So he broke every single construct that built the American inverted commas empire, because it is an empire. You just have to recognize it. And an empire therefore has a footprint, it has a maintainable border and power imprint. All of those he's just destroyed. I mean, I think the attempts to grab Greenland are a lot more sinister than just, I'd like that piece of land, please. He understands that it's like a wedge between NATO. So I think he is completely different. He is a saboteur of note, and it is not aligned with the people he leads or the democratic system he sits in.
I mean, obviously, there's a whole different perspective on that from the American side, which we would find hard to understand, because they look at America carrying the burden for all those decades, as they see it, during the Cold War, and continuing to lead the way and carry the burden post-Cold War, Afghanistan, Iraq. I mean, they were, you know, they've got their own story to tell and their own problems. So, I mean, in some ways, as presidents prior to Trump recognized, NATO has needed to pull its weight and make investments in its defense rather than just rely on America. So you could say that another part of Trump is that he decided to take the decisions that would finally end that reliance, that dependence in Europe upon America for certain things. And actually, without him doing that, and I'm just giving the other side of the coin, without him doing that, maybe NATO would not be in the position it's in to, and I know this sounds paradoxical, to resist the Russian move if one comes next against the Baltic states. I mean, do you think that's a valid point of view?
The first thing is, America imprinted Europe and created NATO, not because it was kind or thoughtful, or it basically was an empire that created a footprint from Japan, which it had occupied and made like itself in the form of democracy, to Germany, which had done the same for, and it wrapped NATO around it to protect against the USSR. And from that imprint, it gained huge financial security. And the thing about empires, when they have military footprints, is they gain the economic advantage of the scale of that footprint and its economies and multiplier, which lets them borrow ridiculously at levels no one else could tolerate. So they have lived the way they've lived because they had an empire's footprint. Now, separately, the point that Europe has been incredibly lazy is absolutely right. I mean, we have been complacent. And complacent not just in the money we spent, but actually allowing America to have the key enablers in the NATO structure, which are so difficult to replace right now. And so there is, without doubt, laziness of note. And you know, the only thing that's galvanized that is since 2022, the threat from Russia along the borders. And you can see NATO is a two-tier system, with those that feel directly threatened and changing their social economic structures to support defense spending, and those like Britain that are just totally asleep, thinking that they're safe and forgetting the North Atlantic is an open doorway for us to be, you know, missiled. And on a scale that Ukraine is now experiencing. And so we deserve a kick, like a super kick. But the problem is, if you were going to be a Reagan who'd made the decision that essentially America's resources were limited and you needed to pull back your borders or pull back your commitments, especially in Europe versus the threat in the Pacific, which is overwhelming, instead of throwing bombs at everyone and insulting them, what you really do is quietly behind the door saying that we need to do this strategically. We have got to do this. We are going to do this. And we're going to help you in the transfer. We're going to work together. We're going to keep a coherent, like, alliance structure together. And we're going to move our forces to the Pacific and leave you to look after Europe. And you do it as an adult. You don't throw hand grenades, break relationships. And I'm afraid that that's this really destructive element of what he's done. And if you look at how he tried to undermine Ukraine consistently, dangerously, and the fact that Ukraine has literally risen above every attempt by US president to bring it down and hand it on a plate to Putin, it just shows you again how America has lost power, but it also shows you how destructive Trump is. And that's not a strategic sort of product. They are in a state of withdrawal. And this whole process of the North Atlantic envelope of, you know, controlling America and Greenland is because somewhere in their planning, they see themselves being kicked out of the Pacific and withdrawing from Europe and becoming a smaller system which covers North America. And that's why they want Greenland to envelope, in effect, a new second, like, reduced line of defense. And that is definitely being part of his story too. And that's in line with Putin's, you know, requirements strategically to remove America from supporting Europe, because he thinks obviously Europe is much more vulnerable. And the way we've been behaving until now, he's right. Although we are slowly waking up and Ukrainians are transferring and going through an incredible revolution. I was there 5 weeks ago. And I think the thing that we are now recognizing is, oh, they've got great technology, and they do. How they created that technology is the question we should be asking. And for a long time, I've argued that there are two forms of human thought. There are 30% that are warrior genes, probably going back to hunter-gatherers. And then there are 70% that are agrarians that are just not warrior genes. And if you look at combat statistics from the Second World War, it's roughly 25% aimed their rifles and 75% didn't and just pulled the trigger. And that probably allies to that mode of thought. And what's happened and what happens in war is the migration from peacetime, where they have linearity and it's all okay, to a wartime adaption of a warrior gene that adapts and fights in a very effective way. And I actually would argue that's why we have wars as a human society, because wars are the greatest catalyst of evolution through this lateralization. Going to Ukraine was breathtaking, to meet their senior leaders, both political and military, and see the level of adaption and lateralization. And having spoken at the higher command course and seen our versions of, you know, 51 stars coming through, which are roughly 50% at that level, seeing this total adaption process, giving them an idea and seeing it applied 24 hours later, is exactly what war has done. And the Russians haven't adapted at the same rate culturally. And we need to take that adaption and bring it into NATO and turn us from a system that's not fit for purpose, that's peace orientated, into one that's adaptive and lateralized and prepared to, you know, go to war in a completely different way. And their technology has sprung from that social evolution. And we need to understand that you have to put one foot forward before you get the next outcome.
It's interesting when you say about adaptation, whatever you want to call it. An old friend of mine who has deep insight into certain areas said to me one time when we had a meeting in London that, and he knows all about certain aspects of the later part of the Cold War and where we are now. He said that we had turned, the West and Britain, NATO, etc., turned from being the nimble, you know, adaptational ones into these kind of ponderous bureaucratic behemoths, you know, the defense systems that NATO nations and America had. And now it was the Russians and the enemies of the West that were the nimble ones, the ones that were thinking on their feet. But you're saying there, I guess, from your experiences in Ukraine, that there's a lot to learn from the former Soviets who want to be part of the West, and we should be being very fleet of foot when it comes to adaptation. Is that the key lesson of the Ukraine war?
Well, I think it's the main lesson that we need right now, because we are a super linearized organization, whether it's Europe, NATO, our countries. And what was interesting was I was speaking to, you know, a very senior group, and there was one chap who had this Soviet Union hangdog face. And over an hour and a half, he did not flinch. It was like speaking to stone. And I was talking about lateralization and how Ukraine had done it. And I was fascinated by the process and how we were the opposite side of the spectrum. And afterwards he came up and he said, and I agree 100% with everything you've said. And I'm sure you do, really. He said, I have often pondered about how Ukraine has gone through what you call lateralization. And my answer is that Ukraine is at the periphery of the Soviet Union's empire. And what happens is lateral people are very individualistic. So they migrate away from controls in the center and they go to the periphery. And he said the simple statistic is Ukraine provided most of the NCOs of the Soviet army. So there's obviously a makeup already there in the Ukrainians that you know, 2014 into 2022 fed into. Just like Britain is highly lateralized because it's maritime culture. So there are certain places that have natural genetics to you can harness, and others in the middle of Russia where you don't have them because land masses tend to be less adaptive because they rely on internal communication and orders and hierarchy. So I think there's a fundamental disposition there between Ukraine and Russia, which is actually not just their old industrial base, but their increased lateralization at the periphery. And that's been harnessed and totally underestimated in terms of what's allowed them to adapt and respond the way they have. The other thing that's interesting is that they've gone from a population of 44 million to 24 million. I mean, literally, in terms of building an economy, it's a nightmare for the Department of Economics. But essentially, I've often pondered this idea of the weak links in society. And so in Second World War, we just conscripted everywhere because no one could get away. Whereas the weaklings have left Ukraine, and what's left is a country of strong links. And if you think about going to war, you go to war with a chain of people all have to act and be together, and a weak link could sabotage it. So there's something about the strong link theory in Ukraine too that's not to be underestimated. And as their technology has become force multiplied rather than people orientated, that's really started to play in the unmanned systems groups. There's now 14 of them, and the war in the Black Sea. There's really, really something we have to learn from them. And again, it's their technology is fascinating. Their innovation cycle is fascinating. It's the people. And these individuals who are in their SMEs and building things have been supported by their government, whereas across Europe, SMEs are just left dangling. Our procurement system is like the old Soviet system. It's centralized. And until we change our procurement, we can't fund our SMEs in a way that really takes advantage of what I think is a hugely creative Europe, because the people that started their businesses in 2022 were the adapters saying, I need to do something for those Ukrainians. And they're the people we need to feed and invest in.
Before we go back to Iran and its consequences, we might as well, as you're talking about the new uncrewed or unmanned technology and how they've adapted that sort of thing for the new warfare and the theatre of war that is the Black Sea in Ukraine, and maybe go and look at the British, because before we go back to Iran, because I know, you have given me a list of bullet points, but I think we'll go down straight to Britain and its problems, because one of the things we point out in the magazine, which sometimes people misunderstand on X, who are all for the dreadnought moment, not understanding what the reality of the dreadnought moment was. Not everything went out of the window. The pre-dreadnoughts were still there at the end of the First World War and did a very useful service during the conflict. And then they talk about, we must, you know, look at the Ukrainian question and follow what they do immediately. But the Black Sea has always been atypical. It's never been the same as the Atlantic or the Mediterranean or the Pacific in terms of naval warfare. So we would argue that you could take bits of what the Ukraine war is showing us on land, air and sea, and then look at bits of the potential struggle for the Atlantic, a struggle that's already underway. And what you mustn't do is take a leap, which maybe some politicians would like us to do, because it seems cheaper, flashier, more shiny, as Lee Pilgrim said on a previous podcast, and just bin all the conventional warfare platforms that you actually need to cope with the Atlantic, you know, your SSNs, your frigates, and things like that. So the challenge for Britain and the North Atlantic Treaty Organization nations, apart from those, you know, directly facing Russia on land, is surely to take little bits of Ukraine or those lessons you've talked about, but be careful to realize that at least for another 20, 30 years, you're going to need heavy metal firepower to take on the Russians and successfully neutralize them, a little bit more conventional. Do you think that's the case?
I've got to intercede and say I love Warships magazine. Every time it turns up, it's I'm a kid when it arrives. And, you know, your views and perspectives that you echo are spot on. And I would agree 100%. I think we need to just, you know, dice it a bit. You're dead right at the revolutionary moment of the dreadnought. We tend to focus on the big gun ship that came out of the war with Russia and Japan. And Britain was not the only country built it. Italy and Japan both had similar ship designs. It's just we built it within a year at Portsmouth, which was just remarkable. But we need to understand something, and that is revolutions in military affairs are stages when power systems are overturned by new weapons and their socialization. Because you've got to remember, the weapon doesn't work unless you socialize it into a new structure within your armed forces. And what the Navy was going through with Fisher and Churchill was a massive shift, a shift in terms of power, shift in terms of gunnery, a shift in terms of, you know, centralized gunnery systems, all embodied in the dreadnought and super dreadnoughts that came afterwards. But they kept the old pre-dreadnought force, which was big enough to take on any two countries at any one time. They were building aircraft carriers. They were investing in submarines reluctantly because they was, you know, didn't want them to really threaten them, as we found out when we lost three cruisers in 1914 to one submarine. And they were investing in in mine warfare. So it was a broad front evolution, and they didn't really understand which piece of that puzzle was going to be dominant. You can't. A revolution in military affairs is not a predictable experience. So you can't afford to say, oh, throw that one out and have this one, because you might well throw the wrong thing out and have nothing. So what you should be doing, as you quite rightly say, is you take your older systems, you integrate them with the new systems, and you let the new systems prove themselves. And, you know, what we're seeing in the UK is I can't express my frustration at, you know, a decade of Conservative and now Labour governments that have destroyed the Royal Navy consciously. And if there's one person I hold responsible more than anyone else, it's Starmer over the past 2 years, because everything was just about holding together. The shoelaces were hanging on there, and he just made the shoelaces popped and the soles of the shoe fell off. And the man is irresponsible and delusional in terms of the threats we face versus the state of the Royal Navy. And understand that, you know, the Royal Navy is the most complex of our warfighting capabilities, because it takes years to build ships, train people, integrate them. And that's a cycle that once you start to break it, you're really in trouble. I mean, we're not, you know, letting certain forms of young subalterns through anymore, because there's no positions on ships to put them into, and they sit around not doing anything. So the whole system's come to a grinding halt. You know, yes, Type 26s will be great when they turn up, but we've given two of them to Norway and we haven't ordered the ones at the back of them. And, you know, what's happened to our Type 23s? Well, they're great ships, super sub hunters, second only to 26, but now their hulls are twisted and torqued and they're rotting at a state where they're very capable warships, but we don't have any. And our Type 45s should be the best air defense destroyers in the world if we'd upgraded the Aster 30s to NT capabilities like the Italians and the French are doing this year, next year. We would have effectively Aster 30s that have terminal intercept capabilities. We've got the capability, and the marginal amount of money to do it is small. It's a loss of willpower, and it's a failure to remember we're a maritime culture. And if we don't protect our outer moat of defenses, which is the seas around us, we are totally vulnerable. And I think we are having a cultural failure of identity to actually allow our Navy to be put in this position. So what do we do with it? Well, you know, the next First Sea Lord has turned up and said, we're going to become a hybrid Navy. And yes, it's cheap to go and make these hybrid small things and counter it. But as you say, we have two battles. We have the biggest battle is the North Atlantic and the Iceland-Faroes gap and out to Bear Island. It's not only bottling the Russians up from the Northern Fleet. And remember, the Russian submarine fleet, as you know all too well, with their Yasin-class subs, are highly capable ships. You have to wait about 5 years before the reactors flare up and you can hear them underwater, as the Severodvinsk was first heard off Spain. But they're new enough to be dangerous, silent, and, you know, they are using them in ways, especially with their underwater capabilities, to sabotage cables. And we do not have the capability when our astutes are stuck in the dock, our ASW TAPS frigates barely work in the Northern Atlantic. And our role in NATO was to protect the North Atlantic, and we have let NATO down ourselves as well. So what did we do about that? We need to deal with the defense. We need to deal with the Treasury's mindset. And when Liz Truss tried to do that, she was deposed. When the first permanent secretary was removed, all hell was let loose and she was kicked out. And if you really look at what happened, the civil servants revolted against her and the more linear parts of this Conservative government. But her ideas are fundamentally right if poorly presented strategically. And that was probably the battle of the Navy that was lost, that no one ever understood at that moment. Things are always going downhill. So now we've got a problem where shipbuilding slowly, and we need those ships because they have capabilities that we desperately must have in the North Atlantic. No drone capability can operate up there in an endurance winter in the North Atlantic storms and still be there. So those ships are vital for what we do. And the carriers would be really helpful too if they're properly protected and their F-35s were lethal and armed with the weapons that was appropriate. And under that environment, we could protect carriers. I don't know whether any of your viewers saw, but the Ukrainians shot down 5 out of 6 Zircon missiles in the past 3 days, which is incredible. These are hypersonic cruise missiles that until now have been impervious to interception. And I suspect the new Aster 30 in the SAMP-TNG, the one battery that was put up there, is probably responsible. Now that could be strapped onto any of our Type 45s. And it's in the Fremm frigates in Italy and France. And so essentially we need to have that capability. But we haven't, because we haven't spent money. So we could protect our carriers if we just spent the money to do it in the environment we're facing. But the thing we're missing, and this is really big, is that we initially face a surge from the Russians. But once war with Russia starts, Murmansk is not a viable base. So every one of those ships is going to have to do its job and go back to Vladivostok. So we'll have a period afterwards when I suspect we don't have confrontation. But what comes next is much more sobering, and that's the Chinese Navy. We will be fighting the Chinese Navy in the high north.
So the Russians, will, what, are you thinking if there was a future hot war, naval hot war, then, and a major one, then the Russians would surge from the Kola Peninsula or around the White Sea down, do their business, beat up Britain, and then go to Vladivostok? And but in doing that, would they, what the, I mean, we're just wargaming here.
Yeah.
Doing that. What would the objective be, to do a sort of passing punch up or dust up of Britain?
They just can't sustain operations back in the Kola Peninsula, when, especially now Finland is part of NATO, because there's one road to the Kola Peninsula, which will be interdicted very quickly. And it's just too close to Norway and Finland to survive NATO airstrikes. And so, you know, they're having a problem with Ukrainian, like, basic drones. So it would be a non-operational naval base. So they have his leverage is a one surge power, in my estimation. But that's not our primary threat. Our real threat is the build out of the Chinese Navy that will come over the top. And that's the thing we need to be prepared for. And sooner than we think, at the rate they're expanding their Navy. So we need the larger units, as you quite rightly say, supplemented by a much more automated system in between of sensors and effectors. And then you have the other problem, which is what's taking place in the channel. I mean, the signals we've been sending Putin by letting an RFA tanker escort a warship, or a mine hunter with a, you know, 30mm gun, or a river class ship with a gun that doesn't work, is appalling. So just imagine, you know, you talked about our automated process, and Kraken have basically, you know, won the contract for the first of these unmanned vehicles, and they're making the migration at the moment. Just imagine if 8 of them surround any corvette that goes through the channel, and if one of them had started, the corvette had started shooting at basically a yacht, as they did, and I don't believe that was an incident. I think they sat on the rum line off basically the Needles to Cherbourg and waited until some yacht came along and they created the incident. The timing's not an accident. Putin was sending a message. Then one of those vessels is activated and the corvette's no more. And that is exactly what it would be very easy to do. Cost effective. The bigger ships are then freed. What limited ships we have to go north on more sustained operations. That can be done quickly, and it would send a really key message. So, but it's not the solution. It's an evolution, like the dreadnought was. So I think we need to hedge our bets rather than, as you say, just jump for the cheapest outcome and say, look what we've done. I think there's also a space too for an intermediate idea, which I'm really quite keen on, which is, you know, 70 to 80 foot stealthy ships with, I saw this at a naval show and it really caught my imagination, with rear ramps. And they were first of all designed so they could come onto a beach. They were operated by two sailors. They could deliver a small commando with, you know, a surface-to-surface missile or air defense system straight onto the beach and disappear again. And then you had a little node of control for the marine commandos that would operate somewhere in the northern reaches and the coastlines. Great idea. Super force multiplier. But they also created a version with NSMs and other missile capabilities. And you could, you know, they're about 7 million each. So for the price of, you know, a frigate, you could have 200 of these things with ranges of 2,000 miles. They allow you to control the coastlines all the way through the Iceland-Faroes gap, deny them to the Russians with diversified capabilities, and also they become escort vessels and power projection systems, which are just like, you know, semi-manned versions of effect, what we're trying to do with unmanned vehicles linked to a centralized bigger ship. I think we could do things like that, which are cost-effective and quick, and we need to do that if we're going to stay in the game, because I think we're at war with Russia. We have been for 4 years. We're just asleep.
I mean, you're talking about sensible, practical solutions, which is not something that's, I don't think it's even contemplated within the current government or previous governments, because it's just too definitive. You know, it's just, we will protect our nation, we will harm the enemies, and we will safeguard people. And it all seems a bit too Cold War to them, whereas they're stuck in a 1990s peace dividend mindset, and they just can't make that mental leap back to understanding that we now need to deter and therefore protect and be ready for a war. But China, I know, is something you want to talk about. And turning also back to the Iran war, a bit of a pivot now away from the UK. But what has China learned from the, should we call it, the Strait of Hormuz fiasco and also the whole Iran war campaign? What has it learned? Where do we go next with this now that America appears to have given up on trying to prevail, despite all the things that its officials say?
So it's worth winding it back a little bit to the problem China faced after the third Taiwan Straits crisis. And they were faced with two carriers and a MU steaming through between Taiwan and saying, whatever you do, you won't have enough. So they created an industrialized strategy that seduced the West to invest in their industrialization. And they always knew that that industrial base would be the basis of their arms race and challenge to the West. And, you know, we in fact funded our nemesis. And key to that was their shipbuilding capability. Now, one of the things they realized was carriers were optimized to get within 600 miles of the enemy and pummel the enemy with 180 missions a day. So the first thing they decided to do was create access area denial strategies, which prevented a carrier from coming into range and becoming a problem. And we thought in the West, when they chose missiles as their weapon of choice, it was because they could make expensive fighters and they weren't as clever and capable. And therefore, you know, well, that's what people do on the cheap. But what we just didn't cotton onto is that their evolution of missile technology has gone way beyond our idea of technology in the process of manifesting access area denial concepts. And their breakthrough into turning DF-26s in 2018 into ship killers, initially we thought they were inaccurate, so they could just deal with a carrier. And very quickly, the evidence has increased that they can hit destroyers and smaller ships. So that's your whole fleet wiped out. The Chinese understood that if you look at a GS-class ship, it can really only control 28 missiles in the air at one time. So each ship has a 14-missile intercept capability simultaneously. And the net result was if they were escorted a carrier, there were usually three GS-class ships, you know, Trichondra and two early barks, so 50 missiles and two of them would land on a carrier. And that was their statistic for access area denial. And they had built out that system increasingly with hypersonic glide weapons, with systems that are now almost impossible to intercept unless they're at mid-course points. And of course, you know, US Navy ships carry very fewer SM-3s than they do their total loadout of 128 41 cells or 96 in the case of an Arleigh Burke. So the Chinese sort of understood they could put the US at risk. And the US Navy was very slow to understand this, and it's created other range capabilities. It's trying to get the MQ-25, which is refueling, but it just doesn't match the range that they've been denied access to. So that technology was taking place in the Pacific, but they were also doing something we didn't see on the mainland. They were making very resilient, hardened structures to base their missiles in. So when China started to export its ideas, it exported that whole concept to Iran. And we thought Iran's missiles were, again, the cheap version of what to do. And we didn't appreciate, up until this recent struggle, how deep and how many missile cities and how many facilities they'd dug underground that were impervious to fourth and fifth generation air power, dropping a maximum of 2,000-pound bombs. And at the same time, the Chinese upped their development because in one of the earlier process, we saw fattier ones, which are aeroballistic, like a Kinzhal missile. They start off fast and they slow down. But in this recent round, and at the beginning of the last one, the Fatia 2 turned up, and that is HGV technology, as in it wiggles once it's released from the bus, and is incredibly hard for a terminal system like a Patriot 3 to intercept. The only intercept point is at the mid-course with a THAAD or an SM-3 or an Arrow, which is why we saw the mid-course interceptors be depleted. And I think the thing that we should be asking is, it's interesting that China developed technology that we still don't have in the West. Where did that come from? And why did China give it to Iran? And I argue it gave it to Iran to empty those mid-course interceptor magazines, which would then make the Pacific far more exposed to a first strike. So where we are at the moment is America has surrendered. It has not overcome this access area denial problem. And that is just with Iran, yet alone with China, where it's impossible. And at the same time, what we have seen is we don't have the magazine depth to cope with these, you know, HGVs launched at medium range. And so now we're looking at access area denial bubbles out to Guam. And there was a recent piece last week about how China was now looking how to hunt a carrier group further than 3,000 miles or kilometers. And the opening action of that was a submarine attack with the equivalent of Zircon missiles to take out the defensive screen of Arleigh Burke's before you launch more of the HGVs. So they are looking at the control of the Eastern Pacific and really kicking America out of the whole Pacific with this process. Until we create counters, America's in trouble. And this is the end of American carrier power, just as, you know, the battleship, you could argue we created the aircraft carrier, but we didn't really invest in the same way in the Japanese did or the Americans did. And that transition saw the end of our maritime hegemony. This threat to carriers, and we haven't answered how to defend them yet, essentially is the same transition on another scale for America. But more importantly, it's his willpower. I think they could have won the strait. It would have been bloody, would have required America to basically transit its ground forces to an FPV-capable force, because it's now a pre-FPV army, not a post-FPV army. But they could have done a deal with the Ukrainians, and they could have swapped FPV technology and guidance in return for giving the Ukrainians PAC-3s. So it was doable, and it was a surrender by lack of will. An intention.
When you say FPV, you mean first-person view drones. Is that what you mean?
Yes. And I say that because just like, we use the dreadnought, pre-dreadnought, post-dreadnought, armies now are basically FPV armies, like the Russians or the Ukrainians, and everyone else is a pre-FPV army. And if you just go and look at the IDF in fighting Hezbollah, they are having a nightmare because the Russians, via the Iranians, gave them, you know, optical drones that couldn't be taken out by very capable Israeli EW. And you see these drone strikes on facilities, which is making Israel's life really difficult. And it's a pre-FPV structure in that respect. And hasn't fully adapted to the threat.
Right. So that seems pretty grim for anyone that believes in Western hegemony or Western even parity, because they're all seemingly thinking in an actual war frame of mind, whereas politicians in the UK, for example, talk about a war footing, but actually their actions show they're very far from doing that. They're doing the opposite. They're doing a disarmament. They're still doing a disarmament of the UK, and they don't seem to care because they have other political priorities. So one thing you have come up with, or an idea you've proposed, I believe, to try and solve the funding problem for the Royal Navy and the other British Armed Forces is a defence private equity fund. I mean, you're a finance specialist, so is there a way around the government's reluctance to cut welfare and other things?
Yes, let's talk about a route through this, because obviously we've talked about the depressing part of we're not ready, we're not prepared, and we're exposed. And we're led by people that are delusional, blind, and will lead us into a brick wall, are leading us into a brick wall. So what do we do about it? Well, the first thing I tried to do was I created a global forecaster to explain to people the paradigm we were in and the urgency of our moment. And that was basically how the military reached out to me and my involvement with them at all sorts of levels, right to the top, came about. And that includes, you know, from America to across NATO. So it was broad-based. And about a year ago, I realized it didn't matter how much warnings, how many articulations of the scale of the threat we face, we were literally not going anywhere. And so it started a discussion with a great friend of mine who's now my partner in Spitfire, that essentially it has to be driven by adaptive private capital, because our governments and MODs, even if our government says, let's spend money on defense, MOD is not fit for purpose. It's an uber piece linear structure that couldn't even get its fingernails painted on time. It's appalling. And, you know, one of the problems it faces, and if you do an analysis of the First and Second World War, there were roughly 55% in both wars serving officers and civilians. But those civilians had fought. They understood that the mistakes they made in terms of procurement and mechanisms cost lives because they'd been there. What we have is a dual process where we have civil servants who think it's a job, who leave at 5 o'clock and they're going to go to some other part of the civil service, don't understand warfare or weapons, and just are there for a job. And we have our magnificent servicemen who are dedicated 24 hours a day to making sure that we can protect ourselves. And one is sabotaged by the other. And the military have no control over the permanent civil service, over how they go about their daily affairs to create a defensive system. I don't know how you unwind that, apart from a simple one thing I came up with was every person in the MOD has to be a reservist. And if you're not a reservist and not prepared to fight with the weapons that you're procuring and supporting, you'll understand the meaning of it. That was my one solution for radical change. But putting that aside, Spitfire took its inspiration from a woman called Lady Houston. And Lady Houston was a very well-known dancer in London in the late sort of 20s. And she'd been through a few husbands. And she attracted the richest man in London who married her, and he died happily soon afterwards. And she inherited a massive amount of money, or not inherited, but gained all his money. And she was very thoughtful, and she heard about Supermarine down in Southampton, and that we run out of money for the Snyder Trophy, which was really a national sort of competition between the Germans, the French, the Italians, and the British that we'd been winning. And Supermarine had run out of money, and it didn't have it. So she went down there, she gave them all the money they needed, and they worked with the RAF. They won another Snyder Trophy, and her words were immortal: "We will need this plane because we will need fighters because Germany is coming for us." And that was in 1929. And as we know, the Spitfire was an integral part of fighter command and the air defense mechanism that saved us. Not the whole story, but an integral part of it. So, and then what happened with the Spitfire is really interesting. It started the war as the most capable piston engine airplane in 39, and it ended the war as the most capable piston airplane in 1945 after 24 adaptions and marks. So we'll take two things from this. Private capital can make a difference. And the other thing is that you have to have a constantly adaptive process with your weapon systems to ensure that you can stay ahead of the enemy. And the Spitfire team really expounded that. So we created Spitfire Strategic Capital, which is a private equity vehicle. For those of you that don't understand what that means, is we gain money over the period of 5 to 10 years to invest in the thing that we're looking for, which is specifically lethal technologies, which will close capability gaps with the Chinese for NATO countries and its Gulf and Pacific allies. And then we created something rather unique, a mission. That's a mission. Most private equity firms are there to make money. We made a mission, and we ended up with an advisory board that was remarkable, from Wesley Clark to Phil Breedlove, ex-heads of NATO, to Richard Sharif. We've just taken on board some other equivalent levels we can't talk about just yet. Members of the CIA right at the top, heads of the Canadian Armed Forces, ex-First Sea Lord, acting First Sea Lord. And it has just grown to a body of incredibly capable people that are breathtaking. It's not a private equity vehicle. It's a much more internationalized process. We built very powerful links into Ukraine, where members of our team advise the senior command structures there. And we've done something already that no one else has done. And our job is to not only develop land warfare, but also sea warfare. And Atlantic Bastion and the technologies around Atlantic Bastion, and also for the Gulf states, how to contest the strait now against Iran, are all critical parts of our thesis. And it's really exciting. We're in the process of fundraising. We've been doing it for a month, and we're no longer an investment in a private equity vehicle. And believe me, there's very little defense EQ out there that people understand weapon systems and where those weapon systems are evolving to. I'm constantly staggered at, even if when people do invest, it's not with the knowledge of, as you quite rightly said, the dreadnought evolution and revolutions in military affairs and process. It's more like, oh, well, we put our dice over here. So we're in a unique position to make this transformation. And there are other parts of the ecostructure that we wish to introduce, which will change the ecostructure to a much more similar version of Ukraine, where procurement is driven by frontline units in weapons that work, rather than actually centralized allocation of those things that turn up late that people have to fight with that don't work. And that's the revolution of Ukraine that NATO needs to adopt.
So to wrap up the discussion, having looked across all those various areas, including the new defence private equity fund, which is very interesting. Is there reason to be optimistic? I mean, were you, even though you could set up a fund like that, Spitfire, is it going to get through? Is it going to cut through the jungle to actually achieve a latter-day Spitfire fighter aircraft provision, shall we say, or development? I mean, can that happen? I mean, are you optimistic it can get there?
Very optimistic. I mean, the body of people that have joined us are remarkable. They're capable, and they all have one hallmark, which is they are appalled at the way we've managed our defences and literally run them down in the face of increasing threats that are clear. So this process goes back to defence secretaries polishing the cuts and saying we can manage without it, when it was clear we never could. And I wrote a long article of where does responsibility come from in the UK for our defenselessness. It goes back to the Brown Blair era, where essentially the Treasury became equal in status and power to Number 10, and they took a position against defence firmly. And it goes through a body of process of, as you know, introducing the nuclear deterrent into the defence budget than rather being separate, and a series of systematic cuts that never stopped, and a demilitarised body politic that essentially would not recognise that we, especially after 2022, were at war with Russia that considered us their main enemy in Europe. We are defenceless. Our navy is absolutely threadbare. The Russians are making fools of us. Our allies that used to trust and rely on us are just appalled, and our status in the world has imploded. And I was at a speech just to sum this up, and this speaker told the world about all the great things the British Empire had achieved, all the changes to the world we'd made, and how we were respected for things which had continued. And not once did the person understand the pinning and the mechanisms to facilitate it was our maritime hegemony, our relationship with the sea, our power of trade, our power to protect those trade routes allowed us to project our values across the world. And we have forgotten that we're an island. And as an island, we desperately need a navy that is functional, capable, and has a high level of morale and belief. And to do that, we have to invest on a totally different level, and we have to be much smarter about it. One of the things I would love to see is Japanese shipbuilding technology brought to the UK, so every part of our system needs to be challenged, or we won't navigate this effectively.
Okay, well, that's great. A great summing up. And I think you've said a number of things there that will challenge a few people. Often I think that defence journalism can be a bit overcautious and not, shall we say certain things to certain seats of power. But I think you've said a few things there that are well worth taking on. So thanks very much for coming in, David.
Thank you for the opportunity, Ian. And, you know, keep doing a great job of increasing naval awareness with Warships Magazine. It's great. And your views are bang on point. So thank you for all the work you do on that.
Much appreciated. Thanks for listening to Warships Pod. If you want more naval news, views and commentaries, please do get the August edition of Warships IFR, which is out on the 17th of July. Among the features that are on offer, it's a tasty menu, it's something on the UK's defence investment plan, all about drones and jam tomorrow, according to Odin, our lead commentary writer. Plus, there are features on US Navy carriers being worn out by wars, Canada's future destroyer, Russians in the English Channel and all the bother that has resulted, Turkey's firepower display during two major exercises, and also something on the visit of the Royal Netherlands Navy frigate De Ruyter to Japan. Connect with us via social media on X and Facebook, and in both cases that's at Warships IFR. And you can also find us on YouTube at Warships IFR TV. If you enjoyed this episode, please leave a review on your podcast app. Keep your eye on the horizon for our next episode.